Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. My guest for the hour today is Ashley Wells, author of The Cowgirl and the Racehorse, a moving and intimate memoir on the relationship between a girl and her horses. Beginning with a traumatic horse riding accident, Wells reflects on the personalities and character of the many horses, both real and fictional, who've accompanied her through often difficult life experiences, teaching her strength, resilience, discipline, care, and trust. The Cowgirl and the Racehorse is also a scholarly reflection on the many cowgirl narratives, films, television shows, music, and books that mark the author's life passages and with offer complex and compelling images for girls as they grow. Ashley Wells is a writer and teacher. She's currently a faculty lecturer in the English department at Utah State University. Part of that taught in the rhetoric department at University of Iowa, earned her MFA at California State University, Fresno. And she lives in Logan with her husband and menagerie of animals. Ashley Wells, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I wish we could have you in studio, but with the pandemic, we're on the phone. So you live with your husband and menagerie of animals. I guess the key question, do you have access to horses here in Cache Valley?
I do. I'm extremely privileged in being able to have a horse during the pandemic, and I hauled a horse out from Iowa when I moved. So it's been, which was an interesting haul, an adventure, but I've been really lucky to have a horse close to me right now in Logan, Utah.
So you had a horse you liked, you brought him or her with you when you came.
I did, yes. Folks thought that was pretty wild to do, and they wondered why I didn't just buy one out here. But I think, true to the book, I had to haul her out and keep her with me.
Has she liked the transition? Does she like Cache Valley?
She does. Actually, she does. She's been doing great, and we've been getting out a little bit and wandering down the road to explore together.
So during the pandemic, I guess that's probably a pretty good activity, get out on your horse.
It is. It's solitary, so I can do it safely outside. I rarely see folks, so it's been working out really great. I feel incredibly lucky to have it right now.
I think I've read animals can catch this virus. Do you worry about your horse?
I don't. I have seen that animals can catch it, but I have not seen anything about our companion animals, so I've felt okay.
Yeah. Do you have your book with you?
I do.
I wonder if you just read the first two paragraphs from the book. This would be, page one, and then second paragraph goes over to page two.
Sure.
This is striking. This is the first chapter called Rebel, and it talks about your beloved horse, Shoshana. I wonder if you'd have you read these two paragraphs.
Okay. After I lost Shoshana, my horse of 13 years, the grief weighed on me, weakening my bones. I imagined my ribs as bird bones, unsubstantial and frail, wrapped around my organs, the vital parts of me. An ache and homesickness set in that I wasn't able to shake or outrun. At the time, I wasn't ready to take on another horse of my own, but needed to somehow reconnect with horses, to feel their pulsing speed and their quiet stillness, their rhythm and their strength. So I sought out riding partners. After meeting online through an ad she placed in a horse forum, Jennifer and I began riding her horses, Cody and Rebel, each week from her Coarse Gold, California home on top of a mountain. We'd meander through the trails blazed by spindly-legged deer, whom we'd spot sometimes, their delicate ears barely poking through the wisps of weeds and brush. As we moved up and down hills under the low swooping branches, along fences bordering her neighbor's homes peppered across the mountain, we talked for hours. Despite her being 23 years older, we immediately connected, realizing during those rides that we wanted some of the same things out of life. The freedom to wander with our horses, to be powerful and strong with them, to have a relationship with them. We wanted each day to have those magical moments when everything is tender and loving, those moments when a horse drops her head for you to rub her face, when she looks you in the eye and everything just stops.
Later in the book, you talk about you're having troubles with a boyfriend, and you mention in passing that you have girlfriends who don't understand your connection to horses, but they try to understand, right? And the boyfriend doesn't even try. So maybe you have to have this connection to really, really understand this. I wonder if you talk a little bit about this. Which many people share this connection with an animal. In your case, a horse.
Sure. Yeah. I avoided writing about the connection girls have with horses for a while when I started my MFA program, because I didn't see that connection treated very seriously in our culture and literature. So I fought it as much as I could, but I also got my horse Shoshona, who I just read about, passed away, and then I got my retired racehorse Treasure, who I felt that connection with really strongly, and I couldn't avoid writing about it. It's such a strong, compelling connection. And I had a horseback riding accident, which I write about, where I fractured my vertebrae. And still, that connection drew me to horses. I couldn't imagine a world without riding, despite knowing that great risk. And I think, and every horsewoman I know has these close calls. They've had injuries, they've had falls, and yet we still continue to ride, or this horse love that develops when you're a girl stays with you into adulthood while you save to get your horse. It's something I think that it's just this undeniable drive to be close to them, and they're so powerful. They make us feel incredibly free and powerful by proxy, which we don't always get. We don't have many opportunities to feel that way, I think, in our culture. So they're just this incredibly powerful outlet for girls, for women, and just seeing them. I think we see this all the time in advertising or in imagery, statues. Just seeing them can make us feel a bit of that wildness too. Mm.
And there is kind of a dichotomy, right? There's wildness. The horse is a big animal, comparatively, right? You mentioned that your father never quite trusted he always kind of saw wildness in horses and I guess felt a little unsafe. I don't know if he was worried about you riding horses.
He was. Yeah, he was. And, my thesis advisor felt the same way. Who was also a man. My dad did not trust horses. He would come out and see me work with them, but stayed far away and didn't really understand why, even after the injury, I would still feel this strong desire to continue riding or this need to continue riding. And I don't know if he understands. He supports it, certainly, but I don't know if he understands it at all.
Mm-hmm. So, on the one hand, you could imagine, you or another girl or woman think, well, this is a potentially unsafe situation, right? Not your experience for the vast majority of times. But you, you say you feel freedom. You actually feel safe on a horse or safer.
I did. And I did on Shoshona, the childhood horse. I felt incredibly safe with her, and I would set out riding, as a kid, with a halter, I'd get on bareback and take off down the road and felt completely safe. I didn't have the fear of falling at that time. And she and I just felt like I trusted her so much. After my accident, I felt a great deal of fear riding horses. And it wasn't on Treasure, the horse I got in my grad program, but I still felt that muscle memory, that sort of fear run through you, even at the slightest hint of anything. It would just rise up in me. And it was a long process. It took years to begin feeling safer. And I think finding horsemanship that helped me to communicate better with my horses, to appreciate their spirit better, understand their feelings better. better, that made it safer to me. So it became of the utmost importance, and I still don't understand much. I'm barely scratching the surface in my horsemanship, but I saw it as a way of getting to keep this really important relationship to me, my relationship with my horse, and ride safely in a way that still retains that feeling of freedom and wildness without the danger, which is very real in horseback riding. It's an incredibly dangerous hobby, if you can call it that. And I know plenty of people have had close calls or disastrous falls like mine. So I had to keep pulling at this horsemanship thing. I just had to keep learning more. I still have to keep learning more, because to me it's the way of getting to do both and getting to have it safely.
Well, talk a bit about your accident. This, you open the book with this. So your beloved horse, Shoshona, has died. You go out with your friend, Jennifer. You're on her horse, Cody, right? It's interesting. I don't know a whole lot about horses, right? So you talk about his stride. You say his stride was quick and energetic, but it was hurried and rushed. Didn't feel right. And then further, you were a little overconfident, and the stirrups were too high. But you said, "Oh, I'm fine." Right? I wonder if you talk about the horse's stride and how you feel that.
Sure. And that moment was, looking back on that moment after I started to learn more about horsemanship from practitioners I mentioned in the book, like Harry Whitney and Shay Stewart and Russ Jacobs. Growing up learning to ride horses and doing 4-H and showing, I would say, or at least in the book, to keep things straight, I describe it as maybe a more traditional way of engaging with horses. And with that came an attitude that I would ride it out. It didn't really matter if they were prancy, if they were scared, or if they were anxious. I would ride that out, and we would make it through. And it was sort of like a domineering attitude or an arrogant attitude, I felt like, for me, because obviously I could, at a certain point, you can't ride it out. And I was ignoring what he was trying to tell me with that stride, with that anxiety that was bubbling up in him. I did not stop to think about how he was feeling in that, or whether he was with me or listening to me. That was very much the mentality at the time for me. It wasn't until later, working with the folks I mentioned, that I might pay attention more closely to that stride, because it indicates to me a message they're trying to send me about how they're feeling, or it might indicate to me where they're at with me, if they're listening, if we're communicating back and forth. I think I ignored what he was saying to me, and I learned later just how important it is to stop and actually deal with that trouble coming up inside of them.
Mm. So he's heading up a hill, then he bucks, and you go over his left shoulder. You land on your face. It's just horrifying, and a lot of damage down your spine. The when I was reading this, I thought of probably one of the most famous horse riding accidents, Christopher Reeve.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. It was like slow motion. I was incredibly aware as I was going over his shoulder what was happening. And it was because of narratives like that, like Christopher Reeve. My dad brought it up too after the fact. And it was a really scary accident for me. And it was one I had never had an accident quite like that before. You know, you get dinged up, but I had never thought that this was it. That when I landed, this was it. And I did with this fall. So it really raised the stakes for me, especially because you mentioned the damage to my spine. I'm still dealing with the pain associated with that accident. So it's a constant reminder of what can happen. And it lodged in me, absolutely, this fear, this I'm not unbreakable anymore.
And this is some 20 years in, right, to your experience riding horses.
Yeah, it was quite a ways in. I had been riding since I was a kid and on all kinds of horses. And I had been riding Cody for quite some time, too, and felt pretty connected to him. But I just, the hindsight I gained working with some of the horsemanship folks, I just don't think I was aware of, I think I thought I was connected to him, but I'm not sure I was.
Mm-hmm. Now, the book, you also, you make a study of cowgirl narratives. One of those narratives is that you get right back on the horse, right?
Yes, you hear that over and over. It's in songs. You see it in the movies almost, the exact same scene in the cowgirl movies over and over. And I internalized that, absolutely. So I did get back on Cody. And even after my surgery, as I was waking up, I was asking the doctor when I could get back on, when I could ride Treasure again. And it almost wasn't this question, even though deep down I wondered, is this really the wise thing to do? How am I going to do this with all this, this fear? But you get back on, that's what you're told, you ride through it, and you build that resilience, you always get back on.
Is that, but you, I'm guessing you're dealing with a new fear, and a pretty strong fear, I'm guessing.
It did, yeah, and although it wasn't on Treasure, he was still, it happened at the same time that I got him, and he was right off of the racetrack. So he had his own anxieties and fears, and I was learning this new approach to horsemanship, and suddenly all of these doors were opening and these huge questions. I was asking these huge questions, and that fear's still in there, but the more I worked with some of these folks, the more I began to see how our work can support our horses feeling really safe, really comfortable with us, and really with us so that they're not filled with anxiety or worry, that they can carry us through if we're supporting them appropriately. So for me, to get rid of that fear, to challenge that fear, I also needed to learn how to be a better horse person. And a better horse person for Treasure.
Hmm. Let's take a break. I want to talk about that when we come back, and talk about how we treat our animals. This I want to get into this. You recount in the book. We'll treat this after the break. You're talking with some friends on a trip, and you get to talking about why we see more women than men on horses. Why young girls often start out being loving and gentle with their horses, before following into a very different relationship. That and much more following this break.
This is Amy Anderson for Bringing More to Life. We are grateful for the many ways our families and communities support the residents of nursing homes, assisted living centers, and seniors everywhere. This population is at greater risk for being affected by COVID-19. Nursing homes and assisted livings across the nation have placed restrictions on visitors to protect their residents. However, restricting visits does not mean curtailing communication from family and friends. We encourage you to use email, FaceTime, Skype, snail mail, or a simple old-fashioned telephone call to check in with the seniors you know. Communicate with their family or care center to find the best way to connect. Together, we will continue to provide the physical and social support our community members deserve and desire.
Support for Bringing More to Life on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our listeners and the Sunshine Terrace Foundation in Logan, advancing wellness, independence, dignity, and comfort. Information at sunshineterrace.com.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. My guest for the hour is Ashley Wells. She's author of a new book, The Cowgirl and the Racehorse. It's a memoir on the relationship between a girl and her horses. Also, it's a scholarly reflection on the many cowgirl narratives, films, television shows, music, and books that have marked the author's life passages and offer complex and compelling images for girls as they grow. Ashley Wells is a faculty lecturer in the English department at Utah State University. And you can find her at ashley-wells.com. So Ashley Wells, let me just start this segment with something. I've searched for a definition of this word in vain. You'd think, you know, Wikipedia wouldn't let me down, but it has. So you're a horse person. Reading, you know, Western novels and such, you read descriptions of horses, you know, good lines, etc., good stride, etc. And sometimes they'll say this horse has good bottom. I wonder if you can explain this to me. I've searched in vain.
I don't know if I've seen that one.
Okay. Oh, so okay. Maybe I'll have to keep searching. Yeah. It's usually associated with endurance, you know, and maybe it's an older word, but anyway.
My totally uneducated guess would be muscle or movement, but I can't help you there.
Okay, I'll continue the search. Very good, very good. You say as a girl, you'd read Nancy Drew books that your grandmother would get you. And then you'd construct narratives, often very violent, where everybody in your family dies, but you escape on a horse. It's always on a horse.
Always on a horse. It really is. And it's something that's come up when I teach the cowgirl narrative classes. You know, in a lot of adventure stories, the parents need to be out of the way. Because you can't have questions of why is this kid running around without any adults. So they often get rid of the parents. And I think I was doing the same kind of thing but it was so much building this world where it was just me and Shoshona. So the girl in the story, the detective, was always me. And the horse was always Shoshona. And it was always how I imagined us together. So it was just this extension of what I saw us as. But I think it was very much in the tradition of adventure stories where parents are not really part of the equation in some way, like Disney movies, that kind of thing, to free up the kid, free up the girl in this case, to have her adventure.
Did you ever show these stories to your parents?
I think I did. I carried them around in a briefcase.
Yeah, you did.
Everywhere. My grandmother would help me type them up. So I don't think I was hiding them exactly. Mm-hmm. But I don't think we had any conversations about why the parents were always gone.
Yeah. You were a writer even back then and encouraged by your grandmother, it sounds like, which is great.
Yeah. Yeah.
This one sentence strikes me. I wonder if we could expand on this. You say, riding Shoshona, I was strong and fast. This is important, you add. Why was that important?
It was important for a lot of reasons. I think for a girl growing up, and it's something I explore in the book, just the ways girls might be made to feel smaller or bridled or diminished in some way, but I was never that way on Shoshona. It was always this feeling of power or freedom or wildness. I always felt very capable when I was with Shoshona. I didn't even need to be riding her. I could be mucking stalls. I could be feeding. I could be just caring for her in some way. I felt incredibly capable in ways that I just did not feel outside of horses. And I hear this over and over again from other women describing the exact same thing. And that was part of what drove the book. I mentioned before, I was sort of resistant to writing a girl and horse book because I hadn't seen it treated with much seriousness. I think that's absolutely changing now. But I kept hearing women recounting the power and just resilience they felt with their horses, and I felt like I needed to understand why, and why girls and horses, what horses offer girls that they don't, because the trope is there. It's the horse girl trope that we see in our culture, girls obsessed with horses, and there was something very real in that for me, and something very, a very tangible power and responsibility that I felt growing up with Shoshona that she offered me. And it was almost a buffering for the things that happened outside of the arena.
You write that find a sense of peace and connectivity, on a horse. You're not alone in this, you write. Most horsewomen in my life have described similar experiences. And you say, from cowboy stories, men wandering across wide ranges on their horses, you know men are capable of feeling this connection too. But you say, I haven't met any who do, aside from a few horsemanship trainers. Well, how do you explain that disconnect, that gender gap there?
Yeah, I don't know. My brother tried riding horses growing up, and it didn't offer him the same thing. It just didn't feel, I would almost say it feels just like your life. Sometimes, like for me, it was never a question of whether horses would be in my life. And I also didn't hear them talked about, I didn't hear men talking about horses in the ways that I heard women talking about horses growing up. I didn't hear them talking about friendship. I didn't hear them talking about trust as much, or doing the kinds of things that I did with Shoshona, like the loving kind of part of it. I heard, and I still hear sometimes male trainers talk about horses as, having an attitude or being disrespectful. So in these terms that feel very much like domination, like the human dominates the horse. But something that just, I was enthralled with hearing, these horsemanship trainers I write about, I was introduced by women, horsewomen at the barn to Harry Whitney and Ross Jacobs and Chase Stewart, these horsemanship trainers that I never heard talk about horses like that. And it matched what I grew up thinking about and feeling with my horse, his friendship and his companionship. And I don't think they use those terms, but it felt that way to me. It felt like more complimentary to this attachment I had to my horse that wasn't hinging on domination.
Mm-hmm. So I referenced before the break this question. You're traveling with some friends, and you get to musing why we see more men than women with women than men with horses, and why young girls often start out being loving and gentle with their horses before following into a very different relationship, an arrangement that hinges on control, domination, and attachment. I wonder if you talk about that.
Yeah, it was something that puzzled me coming into the horse world anew with Treasure, and it still puzzled me, frankly. I would encounter women talk about, like, we would pick up this language and we would internalize this sense of domination. And I did it too. That's how I learned. But that was all that was available to me, learning about horses. And it was very much you teach them a lesson kind of thing. And it was very much around submission. And I couldn't really understand how we begin to internalize that. And I, as I thought on it more and I wrote about it, and I still don't have all the answers with that, but I think fear is part of it, certainly, where, we don't want to have these dangerous experiences. We don't want to fall and domination can get our horses to not do that, we think. But the bind was I didn't always see that working out well for the horse, and I couldn't understand how we still felt like we had these really strong relationships with our horses while we were doing that. And I know it was true for me. I I approached Shoshona in that way, because frankly, the horse world is still very much bifurcated, with women at the bottom and male horse trainers at the top. And I think some of that comes through in some of that old mentality, that traditional mentality that we apply to animals, all kinds of animals, really, and not just horses, but I think especially horses. And I'm troubled by the way we talk about them in a broader sense in the horse world. I hear it over and over, and it sort of makes me cringe, because we kind of project what we think we see onto them, and I'm not sure we're always very good. And this is not a popular thing to acknowledge. We're not always all that great at really understanding what they are feeling, and we see disrespect maybe, or a bad attitude when perhaps there's real trouble in them or real worry in them.
So not understanding what they're feeling, and I guess in, you know, a swath of the horse world, not really wanting to understand, you know, just control, right?
Yeah, and that was something that was another one of the big questions I just found myself obsessed with, is sort of, why is this an unpopular opinion in the horse world? A horsemanship trainer that I worked with, Ross Jacobs, posted online a while back, just pointing out often in horse sports, there are no blood rules, so you're disqualified if you bring up blood on the horse. And he was pointing to something that had happened, and just for the love of the horse, aren't we supposed to be a little bit better than this? I found myself wondering, you know, why do we need no blood rules? What are we doing? But that's entirely unpopular in the horse world, because we think we're training. We describe it as training, and it's part of the discipline. It's part of tradition, and it's hard to hear. You know, I felt a great deal of guilt looking back on how I interacted with Shoshona as I learned more. And I still, as I'm learning, this is, you know, I'm removed from the book now by a couple of years learning more. And I feel guilt for treasure for the mistakes that I make. And it's a process. And I think it's something we struggle with animals. Just generally, we're not always great at seeing them as individuals. And that maybe we're reckoning with that now, how we view animals. And I think horses need to be part of that.
You're right that it's interesting, especially here in the West, where we're bound up in a certain image of the West, right? And and very much into rodeo culture, right? I hadn't known this. You said early on, cowgirls participated in I guess a lot of the events. Before, you say they were shoved to the sidelines, given two choices: barrel racing or rodeo queen.
They did. They participated, and they rode the Bronco. You know, they did all of the events, and Joan Burbick wrote this incredible book on rodeo queens, retracing this history, and it's really great, but she describes a bit of that shift. Folks from more urban areas not necessarily wanting to see women getting pummeled by horses. And Bonnie McCarroll was the final straw for women in rodeo, when there's this infamous picture of her landing on her head. It makes me hurt and reimagine my accident all over again. But that wasn't even the real fall. She tragically died in a rodeo event in 1929, and that was an opportunity to ban women from rodeo. But women have very much been a part of all of these events and continue to be a part of these events. And there are a number of women's rodeo teams that are challenging this now and also challenging whiteness in rodeo and kind of the male domination in rodeo. There's the Cowgirls of Color rodeo team who made news a few years ago, but there are other rodeo teams challenging this belief that women should only do the barrel racing or, rodeo queen events. It's sort of these two options that women were given when they were banned from these events. But I think I'm seeing more women challenging that and trying to reclaim it a bit.
I want to get it. We'll take another break and we'll get into the narratives. Interesting is have you talk about some of these movies and books that you treat in the book, but in a kind of a 30,000 foot way, you say the throughout time and culture, the image of the woman has vacillated between the unruly one who needs to be bridled and subdued and the benevolent mother figure who nurtures and gives. I think we're all familiar with these themes. The woman being connected with the natural world. And horses kind of, seen this way too. There's something in parallel in the portrayal, or am I going too far there?
No, I think that's spot on. I would argue that the parallels are there.
So let's take a break. We'll come back and talk about this through the lens of some of these movies and books. We're talking with Ashley Wells. The book is The Cowgirl and the Racehorse. More following this.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Idaho National Laboratory, where researchers are modernizing the country's irrigation systems that will benefit farmers, enhance aquifers, and bolster power resilience. More information can be found at inl.gov.
President Trump has attacked his opponent's political record.
Joe Biden has been on the wrong side of history for 47 years.
Biden says four more years of Trump would mean chaos.
You are not safer in Donald Trump's America.
I'm Audie Cornish. Join NPR Tuesday night for special live coverage of the first presidential debate from NPR News.
Beginning Tuesday evening at 7, right here on Utah Public Radio.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, and this week we're talking cooking for and feeding your kids. We've got Kenji Lopez-Alt on the science behind making mealtime less stressful, and Chef Dave Chang and Chris Ying on their best home hacks for making mealtime easy and delicious. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
Tune in Sunday at noon on Utah Public Radio.
Thanks for joining us for Access Utah. My guest for the hour is Ashley Wells. The book is The Cowgirl and the Racehorse. Ashley Wells is a lecturer in the English department at Utah State University, lives in Logan. And brought with her from Iowa her horse. So that's great. She's you can picture her out on her horse periodically. I want to talk about some of these, part of the book is these narratives that have, a powerful effect on girls, I guess, especially girls and women, and talk about what they mean. I want to talk a little bit about National Velvet. I think we've probably all seen and International Velvet, right, is the sequel. Elizabeth Taylor. And what is the horse? It's called The Pie, right?
Mm-hmm.
The horse. Talk a little bit about this and what and the meaning, I guess, and what that narrative stands for.
Sure. As I started the book, it occurred to me that I couldn't explore my relationship with these horses without the movies and books and, every horse narrative I could get my hands on growing up. I was just obsessed. And I know a lot of horsewomen who are exactly the same. And National Velvet was one of those. Wild Hearts Can't Be Broken. There were these movies that represented for me, the same things that Shoshona did, that my horses did. And I think that they represent similar things for horseless girls too. And their interests, they're just endlessly interesting to me because, on one hand, they're very unique in our media because they're featuring girls who are out having adventures. They're girls who are shown as being very capable and stubborn and sometimes even unlikable in, you know, Wild Hearts Can't Be Broken, one of the narratives I write about. She's not a particularly likable or glamorous character, but she's still the hero, and she's still the protagonist. She's centered in it. National Velvet, she's incredibly resilient and stubborn. She's going to ride the pie. She's going to have her horse. And they're also so often featuring similar storylines in that the right horse will come to the girl, and she's right for that horse. So in National Velvet, the pie was this wild horse. The owner, he was always destroying things and getting loose, and he was shown as being very unruly and out of control, except for with Velvet. And, of course, she's destined to get this horse through the raffle they hold, and she does, because she's the girl meant for the horse, and she can bring out the best in him. And we see that a lot in some of these narratives. And it's interesting, too, you mentioned the parallels before the break, where the girl can be wild with the horse, and often it's a damaged horse or horse that no one wants that she can bring out really incredible things with. But there are also these scenes of her nurturing and caring for the horse. And sometimes my cowgirl students, we would notice this come up in several different narratives where the horse suddenly falls ill and the girl needs to take care of them. And it's the shorthand for how much they love this horse. And Melissa Holbrook Pearson wrote this book called Dark Horses and Black Beauties, and she describes how, you know, we've simultaneously exalted them as a symbol of freedom and wildness, but we've also infantilized them to where they need us for almost everything. And I think the movies sometimes show that nurturing too. But I find them to be really unique in what they allow girls to see and see themselves doing. But just like with everything else in the book, I find that there's also this darker side and that they're not diverse. They don't demonstrate sort of this wide range of access to horses. So not everyone can see themselves in these stories. So just like our history of the West and the power that horses offer women, our narratives also have their dark undercurrents too, I think. But at the same time, they're doing something very different than a lot of the movies that we see featuring girls.
Hmm. What if you talk about The Horse Whisperer? This, you know, very important narrative, right? 1998, so it's that long ago. Doesn't seem that long ago. So Grace and her horse Pilgrim suffer traumatic injuries in an accident, and then together they begin a rehabilitation process with the Horse Whisperer, Tom Booker, played by Robert Redford.
Yeah, and it's an interesting movie to me for a lot of reasons, of course, but obviously my own accident, I'm pretty drawn to the two recovering together, but it's also another one of those girl and horse narratives where the girl plays a role in that. But I also find it to be one of the few that features a more perhaps maybe humane approach to horses, and that's because the character, Tom Booker, the horse trainer character, is based off of horsemanship trainers who are doing this real life work where they're actually seeing the horse. And it's all set up, of course, for the story, but you still see the hints of that where the horse is actually seen as troubled too and traumatized from the accident, that he too needs support, and you see echoes of the horsemanship practices in it as well. And it's one of the few I've seen that show the horse, where the horse is seen. I think Black Beauty is one narrative where it's special in that the horse is telling the story. The horse is the protagonist. We get the horse who's really seen in the characters. But I wanted in the book, my book, I wanted the horses to be seen too. I wanted them to be centered in it because they might not always be in a very accurate way in our horse narratives. They might be more symbol than individual or nuanced animal.
Yeah, I think that's very much the case, right? Especially these narratives, the horse as a symbol, right, instead of as a as an actual, you know, character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we put so much on them. We see them as this symbol for, you know, freedom and wildness, and yet we, you know, the way we treat horses in the U.S., especially feral horses, which are our quote-unquote wild horses, we round them up, and we don't always do it in the most humane ways. And horses, you know, are sent to slaughter when they're no longer profitable. Is troubling. So we have these sort of warring narratives about the horse as symbol of what we want to be, what we see ourselves as sometimes, and then the reality, those boundaries are a lot more blurry for us. We don't always follow through. We don't always do right by the horse.
Tell me about the television show Heartland.
Oh, yeah. I found that one interesting. I wasn't, it was sort of, you know, a little bit hokey in some ways, but I found it interesting in the same ways I liked the Horse Whisperer, in that it seemed to be one of the few out there showing a different kind of approach to horses. Sometimes I didn't see them breaking horses, and I hate that language around it. I didn't see them humbling a horse, as Melissa Holbrook Pearson would say. It was in that category with the Horse Whisperer where I felt like this is maybe a turning point in our cowgirl narratives, where maybe we'll start to see this horsemanship more normalized or accepted, instead of maybe the more domineering, let's break them sort of way. You've got to ride it out sort of way.
And you mentioned the book Princess Smarty Pants, which I'm not familiar with this. As it relates to horses and riding.
It was another one of those books I absolutely loved. The princess in the story has a white horse. She's surrounded by animals, and I loved it. And I took a look back at it as an adult, and especially as an adult teaching women's studies and, you know, having quite a bit of distance from it. And I thought, why did I love that book so much? But rereading it and looking back, the whole story is about this princess who is sort of living it up with her animals, and her parents decide it's time to marry. So she creates all of these challenges for the princes just to avoid marrying someone. And she eventually turns the winner into, I think, a toad. And looking back, I thought, wow, it's real in that so many of the horsewomen I speak to they like being around their animals. They are drawn to this, this world with their animals. There are jokes in the horse world about boyfriends or horses, which is sort of mirroring a little bit of the Princess Smarty Pants thing. And I wanted to know, I was just wondering why that resonated so much with women. It was a question I found myself asking in the book. What is it? What do our animals offer us that our relationships with people maybe don't? And I think there are a lot of things they do offer us. They give us, opportunity for peace and unconditional love. In my case, it was complicated with the accident, but it became a lot clearer to me when I started working with the horsemanship practitioners I mentioned. they don't demand anything of you, and they're this vessel for almost your potential, at least horses are. And I just, yeah, Princess Smarty Pants is just a kid's, it's a kid's book. It's really cute, but it just seemed to have that kernel of truth that all cowgirl narratives have that make it resonate with us. And I think maybe through adulthood too, because I know it was similar with Wild Hearts Can't Be Broken. It was something I was, the movie I was obsessed with. I read a chapter about that obsession and revisiting it as an adult. And it doesn't necessarily, I've tried showing it to my students and it doesn't necessarily hold up. But there was, you know, there was still that draw and that bit of truth in it for girls, I think, that, you know, we find ourselves drawn to these narratives about our animals, at least horse girls do. Mm-hmm. And Princess Smarty Pants was one of them for me.
We just have about a minute and a half left. I want to end with, just briefly, with this passage which struck me. Going back to the beginning, you talked about your accident and chronic pain, which has resulted. You say chronic pain acts as a steadfast reminder of the very literal risk of very real injuries and fatalities involved in riding horses, but also of the symbolic and complicated relationship between risk and identity. Inspiring contemplation of why I'm so compelled to continue riding despite the ever-present clear and serious danger. So the complicated relationship between risk and identity, I want to just in a minute expand on that.
I think the accident brought home for me that if I don't, well, the risk is there, the danger is there, I would lose identity. My identity has been so tied up. Horses have offered so much in terms of resilience and discipline and understanding of boundaries that I have, communication, that I, not riding, again, I risk losing that. I risk losing so much of myself and how I see myself in the world.
Interesting. Yeah. A good place to end the conversation. We're out of time. Ashley Wells is a lecturer in the English department at Utah State University and lives in Logan, obviously. The new memoir is The Cowgirl and the Racehorse, which is out now. And you can find Ashley Wells at ashley-wells.com. Ashley Wells, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it.
And thanks, everyone, for listening.
This is Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences, KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU-FM Logan, and also heard at upr.org.
Utah Debate Commission has organized debates for candidates for all of Utah's congressional districts, as well as for candidates for governor and attorney general. UPR is broadcasting all of these. And the next debate up features candidates for Utah governor. The Democratic candidate, University of Utah law professor Chris Peterson, will debate the Republican candidate, Utah Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox, on Tuesday evening at 6. And we hope you'll keep listening after that debate for the first presidential debate, which follows immediately after. It all begins Tuesday evening at 6 here on Utah Public Radio.
That's coming up tonight here on UPR. Don't miss the gubernatorial debate and first presidential debate beginning tonight at 6 o'clock on UPR.